Good morning, everyone. How is everybody here? Everybody good here? Yeah? Good. So this is meditation. This is about for dummies, right? So everybody here is dummies, is that right? If you're not dummy, you can't be here. So the idea is just to, sometimes you have to, to do things in a simple way. Because when you understand the Dhamma in a simple and straightforward way, then it goes to the heart and you can actually use it in your daily life. So that is the idea. I'm sure you have seen all these books, right? Go to the bookshop, this for dummies, that for dummies. It's the same kind of idea. Thank you very much. Very good. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about dependent origination. You all heard about dependent origination, right? One of the things about dependent origination is that people often think it is a very theoretical subject. It's something you have to study intellectually, right? You look at all the factors of dependent origination. We try to understand them and you kind of think about it. And it is one of these theoretical intellectual subjects. But the reality is that all of Dhamma, the whole of the Buddhist teachings, is not really about theory as such. It's about practice. It's about how we use these things in such a way that we can put it into use in our daily life. And it's only then that it becomes powerful, right? It's about what we use, how we use these teachings, how we apply them that actually matters. Just thinking about things, being like the armchair, the armchair Buddhist, right? Is the one who's kind of reflecting, thinking about the dependent arising, but doesn't apply them in their own life. It's pointless. The whole purpose of Buddhism is application. And one of the surprising things that you will find is that if you use something like dependent arising or dependent origination itself, and you look at it carefully, you actually realize that it has a lot of applicability in our ordinary life. It's not just theory, it's not just an intellectual exercise. If you use it in the right way, you can actually apply it. This is what I mean by dependent arising for dummies, right? Not think about it, but apply it. So it's not actually for dummies at all, it's for smarties, right? Dependent origination for smarties, so welcome to the smarties club. So you are now in the right place.
So this is the whole point. I want to point out to you, if you want to have to think about dependent origination in the right way, you actually can apply it in your own life, you can use it in a good way. So I can make progress on this wonderful, amazing, powerful, a spiritual path forward. And just to get us started, I want to just give a little bit of overview of what dependent origination is all about. You may probably know that dependent origination has 12 factors, right? Beginning on one end, we have avidya. In the Pali word, it means something like ignorance, illusion, lack of understanding, wrong view, all kind of things. And on the other end of these 12 links, you have dukkha, suffering, right? And in between those two ends, you have 10 other links. And each one of those links is connected. It's connected in a way, in a causal sequence. So each one becomes a causal factor for the factor we come back to. Right? So what that means is that if you have avidya at the beginning, because that is a causal factor for the factor which comes afterwards, which is called samsara in Pali, which is that once you have avidya, you have factor number two. It must come as a consequence. Once you have factor number two, you must have factor number three. If you have factor number three, number four must be wrong. And so it goes all the way through the chain, all the way to get to the last factor of the tennis origination, which is dukkha. So what this means, and this is the power of dependent origination, what it means is that if you have ignorance, if you have the avidya at the beginning of the dhamma, you must have suffering as a consequence. Avidya, lack of understanding, wrong view, delusion about how the world actually works, always must lead to suffering as a consequence. Ignorance leads to suffering, right? I'm sure you all heard the English expression, ignorance is bliss. No, that is not a good idea. It's not policy. Ignorance leads to suffering, right? It may be a bit of short-term bliss, oh, I don't want to see reality, I don't want to know what's going on there. But in the long run, actually, it's bad for you. The Buddhism is sometimes you can't trust the intent of the world, right? Sometimes a very shallow understanding. So throw those down and go to the real, the real understanding. So ignorance, avidya, always leads to suffering. How is that the case? So it's not obvious, right? How about ignorance would lead to suffering? And the way it works, one of the important steps on this 12 steps of dependent origination is that it's in there somewhere, that it's the idea of rebirth. Right? So the way that this functions is that because of avidya, we get reborn, and because we get reborn, it means that we continue on, and we always experience the same problem. And These are the two things that people tend to hold on to. And depending on your proclivities and how you think about things, you tend to choose one or the other. Some people think, oh, life is so wonderful, it means so great, when I die, I want to live on forever after. Other people think, oh, life is absolutely miserable. When I die, I just want to disappear and get out of here. I remember there was one of my monastic friends, and he was a Buddhist, obviously, he was a Buddhist monastic, and he said to his auntie, he said, you know, when you die from here, you're going to be reborn. And she said, oh no, I don't want to be reborn, right? I want to have to be finished with it. I had enough with this character. He was one of those people that suffered from the life. I don't want to go on anymore, I just want to be complete blank and finished with this auntie, he said. Sometimes we think that everybody is attached to life, but it really depends on the kind of experiences you have had in life, whether you are an eternalist or you are an annihilationist. So then the Buddha comes along, right? And he says that eternalism is life, nor is annihilation in life. There is a middle way between those two things, and that middle way is called dependent origination. It's a different way of looking at the world. So both eternalism and annihilationism assume that there is some self inside of you that either goes on forever or gets annihilated. That's why it's called annihilationism. But you have said no. That is actually the wrong way of looking at it. There is a midway. That's the fourth way of being right. And this is one of the more profound teachings of the world. And that's what I've heard about now. Maybe at the retreat sometimes I go into these things, but not today. This is a little way between us. So it shows you how the process of rebirth, the process of suffering, how it sustains itself without the permanent form inside of you, without the self. This is one of the things that kind of origination shows you. So this is one of the reasons why it is considered so profound and so difficult to understand. How difficult to understand? It takes a lot of practice, a lot of insight, and then you can understand it. So, I hope I'm making sense to you. If not, that's okay. You don't have to look at my attention. Now I'm going to get into the more practical aspect of this teaching. And I'm going to look at more the beginning of this whole sequence and the Vita. Because obviously, it is very interesting when you have a teaching which shows you how the suffering comes about through a whole series of causes. Very interesting, right? We don't want to suffer. So if we can understand the quality of giving life to suffering, maybe we can do something about suffering. This is a nice thing about it. This is one reason why dependent origination is so useful. Because we can do something with the problems that we have in life. Now, the first question that arises for me when I hear this, I think, wait a minute. We already have the second noble truth, right? The second noble truth is about the origin of the arising of suffering. And the second noble truth says it's craving that is the cause of suffering. So which one is it? What some people say. So which one is it? Is it craving or is it ignorance? What is, let's be clear about this. What is actually the problem here? Craving or ignorance? And the point here is that craving and ignorance can always go hand in hand. These are not different things. There is a different way of looking at the same problem. The reason you crave is because of lack of understanding in the first place. If you didn't have the lack of understanding, you wouldn't have the kind of craving to what I'm talking about. There's no contradiction there. There's a different way of looking at it. In fact, sometimes you will see it. That dependence arising is put in place of the second noble truth. Instead of second noble truth saying that tanha, craving, is the cause of suffering, he puts in there instead the whole sequence of dependence arising instead. This is the cause of suffering. So two ways of looking at the same thing. And the reason why dependence arising is so useful is because if you think about craving, sometimes you wonder, how can I get rid of more craving? It sounds impossible. Craving is so much part of us. How can you actually withdraw with it? And there is some truth to that. It actually is. You can reduce the craving in life. You can reduce the desire. Our practice in the Buddhist path of the right way. But you can never eliminate craving entirely just by trying to eliminate it. What you have to do is you have to understand the causes for craving. And only when you understand the causes can craving actually be fully eliminated. That is why this idea of going back, not just going back to away to ignorance, Paramita. Why is this so useful? Because it shows you the final cause of why this is happening in the world. The cause that also itself did give right to claim again. So Amida is something we can do something about. We can turn our ignorance, we can turn our delusion into proper understanding. But prayer itself, we can only do so much about it. This is why it's very useful to go all the way back to the very beginning of this world lecture. Because there's more we can do about ignorance, lack of understanding, than there is we can do about prayer itself. So what is this ignorance then, right? Now, okay, if ignorance is the cause of suffering, you want to stop being ignorant, you want to not be deluded anymore, you want to see things in the right way. So what is it? What is this ignorance? What the ignorance is, the lack of understanding, is essentially a lack of understanding of the four noble truths, right? Suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering, the four noble truths. So basically, what we have to do is improve and increase our understanding of the four noble truths and what they actually mean. And as we do that, we are reducing our ignorance. As the ignorance gets reduced, all of these links, all of these 12 links that we have already mentioned, that reduction of ignorance makes itself felt all the way through that until you get to the very end and you also have a reduction in suffering and the consequences. So the more, oops, my Lord is not kidding, bring it to the wrong way. Sometimes that happens if you're minded. Okay, so the more we understand what the Four Noble Truths are about, the less suffering we have in our lives. So try to understand the Four Noble Truths. How can we understand the Four Noble Truths better? To think about suffering, oh, I suffered so much today, so much yesterday, right? It doesn't really work very well. What I'm aware to understand the Four Noble Truths actually is to understand what is the cause, again, of that ignorance. Why does ignorance, why does delusion actually arise in the first place? And what the Buddha said about this is very interesting, because this now we're getting to the very practical side of this, right? The cause of ignorance, the cause of illusion, says the Buddha, is the five hindrances. Driving all of the five hindrances in there. Driving five of the other things that stop you from meditating properly, stop you from being peaceful. There are things like anger, like desire, restlessness, tiredness, driving down. These are the five hindrances. So what we have to do is basically, the stronger these five hindrances are, the more deluded we are, the less we can see these things. The weaker these five hindrances are, the more clarity of mind we have there. And if you think about the Buddha's path the Eightfold Path, it is the path of purification. Usually when we talk about the path of purification, we talk about the Visuddhi Magga, one of the big, enormous book, very kind of heavy, full of, some of it is very nice, some of it is really heavy to read it. But that is actually called the path of purification, but in Buddhism, the real path of purification, if you follow the word of the Buddha, is the Noble Eightfold Path. That is the real path of purification. So if you practice the good practices of the Buddhist, if you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you are purifying yourself. This is what it's all about. When you are purifying yourself, the five hindrances are declining. When the five hindrances are declining, you have less delusion, you have less ignorance. You are seeing the world as
clearly. Okay, you have less ignorance.
Every time you keep the
thought to yourself, every time you come back to somebody, every time you are generous, every time you say to your son or daughter, to your parent, oh, I love you, you know, and give them a nice hug or whatever it is. Every time you do something kind from your heart, coming from your heart, and you are a good person, then you are actually reducing suffering in yourself. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that wonderful? You're practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. You're coming from your heart, just doing what is kind, doing what is nice in the world, because you're purifying yourself. The delusion has gone down. The delusion has gone down. Suffering is also being reduced. It's very simple. All we have to do is live kind lives, live good lives,
be good to the people around us, have a sense of compassion for the world. But when you do that, you're actually reducing suffering inside of yourself. By the way, you're also reducing suffering for other people, right? Because you're kind to them. So it's a win-win situation. If what everybody wants to do, they want to have win-win situations. There you are. That's a win-win situation. So suffering is going down. Ignorance is going down. Now, to understand more clearly, we're taking the time, understanding how this works more clearly, I'm going to have a look at the first three or four links of dependent orientation. The second link of dependent origination, the first one, as I have said, is avijja, is ignorance, is delusion. The second one is called sankhara. Right? I hear sankhara over there. Very good. The second one is called sankhara. How do we translate sankhara into English? And they're also called volitional formations or mental formations, that's true. But I think, actually, that is a very kind of difficult concept to grasp, right? You hear this and think, what does it actually mean? Okay, I understand kind of the word, right? Kind of volitional formations, you know. But what it actually means, but this is, I think, the most important point, is that sankhara, normally the meaning of that in the word of the Buddha, is the will. Right? The thing which says, this is the arm. This arm, right? Those are the things, right? This is the will inside of you that does these things. Every time you do an action, every time you say something, every time you have a thought, it is driven by the doer inside of you, the will, the thing which makes us act in the world. So sankhara, actually, this is what sankhara is. It's the will. It's the thing which makes us act in the world, whatever it is. That's really the best way of understanding those things. Right? So from ignorance, from avijja, comes this activity. We start to act. So why is it? Why is it that ignorance makes us act? What is the reason for that? And the reason for that is because I'm going to point out two aspects of ignorance which are very important in this context. And one aspect is the aspect that we think we know where happiness is, right? We have this idea, oh, I know what happiness is. But according to Buddhism, we don't really know where it is. We have a misunderstanding about this. And that's why we have the first noble truth of suffering. Because it takes an insight into reality to actually know where real happiness and where real suffering is. So we think we know what happiness is, right? So because we think we know what happiness is, what we do is we go out into the world and we seek for our happiness. We do all kind of stuff, right? To get that happiness. Happiness is in relationships. I go to get myself a husband, a wife, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, right? Whatever it is. That is where real happiness is. When I get that, you know, when you're young, you think about this. I remember when I was young, I'm going to have, this kind of wife or whatever, I'm going to have this sort of job, right? Or this kind of career. I wasn't thinking about getting a monk, right? I was thinking about something very different in those days. All these ideas in your head about where happiness lies, you think you know where it lies. And then you pursue that. And that pursuing of the happiness, that is all the activities of the sankhara. You go out, you try to get a date with this beautiful girl, this nice man, right? And then you think you are pursuing happiness in that way. You work hard at school to be able to go to a good university and have a nice job, and you work really hard at your job to get money, and then you think you will be happy, actually you die instead, right? This is a problem. So always, things never turn out in the way we think they will turn out. There's always turn out differently. So we think we know what happiness lies. And because we think we know what happiness lies, and we think we know what suffering lies, we act on that, and we try to find that happiness. And in that pursuit of happiness, we do two kinds of actions. Sometimes we do good actions when we are kind to others, because we think that will give rise to happiness, that will be kind to this heart. But sometimes we do bad acts, right? Somebody is getting away from our happiness. You know, there is you want a girlfriend, and there is another man who also wants the same girlfriend, right? So then you undermine this other man in his ability, and you do even nasty things to stop them, so that you can actually, you know, get that thing started, right? But this is very common, you know, when it comes to relationships, there's always a lot of rivalry and a lot of difficulties in these areas. So because of that, sometimes we are compelled by our craving, by our idea to where happiness is, we are compelled to do bad things as well. So, ignorance, this lack of understanding of where true happiness is, makes us act, and it makes us act in good ways, and it makes us act in bad ways. So this is the first thing to understand about it. This is why avidya leads to sankhara. But the other very important thing to understand about how avidya, how delusion leads to activity, is another aspect of avidya, is the sense of self, right? We all feel that we are a particular person. We all feel that I am this person, these people over there are different. And we all have a sense of self inside of us, unless you're an arahant. But usually there's not that many arahants around, right? Any arahants around here? Not that many arahants around, so usually there's a sense of self there. This is an arahant over, well, he died, unfortunately. So there are still, I think there are still arahants in the world, but they are few and far between, very rare to behold these days. So there is a sense of self inside of you. Now, what that sense of self does, when you have a sense of self, it means that it feels like you are doing these activities, right? I mean, that means you're doing all these activities, but the sense of self says, I'm doing these activities. This is the whole point of the sense of self, is the sense that I am doing things, I am responsible, I am doing all of this stuff. And what that means is that when you do an act, you feel responsible for that act. I did it, right? If you do something bad, you are responsible for that bad act. And you feel, how do you feel afterwards if you're responsible for a bad act? You feel bad, right? You can't avoid that. But if you do a good act, you're also responsible for that. So if you do a good act, you feel good about yourself. So this is the other part of this delusion, or lack of understanding of reality, is that you have to feel responsible for what you do, at least to some extent. This is what the sense of self does. One of the most important aspects of the sense of self is that you think you are the doer, you are the agent behind this, you are have to take responsibility for your actions to a certain degree. Right? And this has very important consequences. Of course, you don't always have to take full responsibility, because if you understand a little bit about Buddhism, about the Dhamma, you also understand that you are conditioned into what you do, right? So you can forgive yourself to a large degree there. Right? This is what any good teacher will tell you. If you do something bad, forgive yourself, say, forgive yourself. And of course, that is very, very useful then. But the point I'm making here is that because of the sense of self inside of us, we can only forgive ourselves so much. Maybe you can forgive yourself 70%, maybe 80%, but you can never forgive yourself 100%. There will always be a residue left in your heart, for which you have, in which you feel responsibility. Because that is the nature of the sense of self. Unless you become a stream entry, and this is the power of the stream entry, right, the Sotapanna, once you understand non-self, only then can you fully forgive yourself. And that is why the stream entry can never be reborn in the bad destination, precisely because of that, because they have the ability to forgive themselves completely. But before that, you have to take responsibility. You have to take ownership of your actions, good or bad. So what does that mean? And this is where you can start to see the next step in dependent arising, the step from sankhara to vijnana. Namarupa, next one. Yeah. Okay, good, I'm just testing you out. So very good, that's already very, very, very good already. So next one is vijnana. Vijnana is consciousness. That's how it's really translated. Good enough. So consciousness, right? Now, the point here is that if you have ownership of your activities, whatever those activities are, if you do something bad, you feel bad about yourself, it affects your mind, it affects your consciousness. like that. If you think, oh, I did something bad, I shouldn't have done that, but your mind is like it's lower down. You know, the feelings aren't so good, right? The perceptions aren't so good. You're kind of hanging your head a little bit, you know, and not so happy in that. Right? So the feeling is very good. And that's what we mean by a low state of consciousness. The consciousness in mind is dragged down as a consequence of your activities, because we have to take ownership of that to some extent. And it's also the exact opposite, right? If you do something good. And I encourage you to reflect on this, because I think it is very obvious when you start reflecting on these things. When you do something very good to somebody else, something very kind, one day you wake up in the morning and you feel so generous. You want to be kind to the whole world, and you do an act of kindness, and you feel so happy inside of yourself because you are doing an act of kindness. You know that feeling? You do something kind and you feel happy as a consequence. Right? That's exactly the same thing, but on the positive side. So what we are doing there, we're taking advantage of the delusion of self, right? So this is all about being clever and skillful about this thing. Because there is a delusion of self, might as well take advantage of it, right? So I'm going to do good, I'm going to feel good about myself. Whether that is really, at the end of the day, whether it's really justified or not, doesn't matter. Because it's leading you in the right direction. I'm not suffering, so I will use that. So this is how you then use that delusion of self. You do good, and you feel so good about yourself when you do acts of kindness. Even just thinking a good thought, often you feel good about that. And this is worthy of a lot of contemplation. And I think all of you will grow in the Dharma if you're able to see these kind of things inside of yourself. It is very powerful to feel these kind of feelings, because when you feel it, you start to feel the power of these activities. Then usually in Buddhism we talk about three kinds of karma. The karma which ripens in your next life, that's usually what people think about, right? Oh, next life I'm going to be reborn in a nice place, I'm going to do all these nice things because of that. Or they talk about the karma which is beyond the next life, the future lies beyond that. But there is one type of karma which is, I think, perhaps the most important one of all. And that is the karma, which is called the Dittela Dhamma karma, the karma in this very life. Right? So what that means is that your activities are not just about kind of having a, you know, nice life in the future life, but actually it's about how you feel, how you experience this life right here, right now. And the way this works is precisely how I was talking about this now. When you do a good act, you do an act of kindness, try to feel, try to experience that act in the present moment. And when you feel happiness, you feel elated, you feel good as a consequence of that act of kindness, you are experiencing the result of karma in this very life, right? This is what karma really is about. You are lifting up your consciousness. Your consciousness is going to a higher level, and that is the real meaning of karma. Very often people tend to be too materialistic about karma. Oh, in my next life I want to be, you know, I want to be a deva, I want to just enjoy myself, you know, having a really good time. And you can sometimes you read in the sutras and you read about Sakya was the king over there, and he had this enormous palace with 700 rooms and seven towers and all these nymphs and all these kind of things, right? And it's strange how we tend to be materialistic about things. But really, it is a mental thing that karma really is about. Sure, these materialistic things may come along as well, but really it's a mental thing that really is about. It's about the level of our consciousness. Is it a high level which feels good, which is light, which is delightful, which is has nice perceptions about the world around us? Or is it more like a dark consciousness, which is kind of held down, which doesn't have that happiness inside of you? This is what it's about. So feel that. And when you feel that, it gives you such a big motivation for doing what is good in the world. Because you feel the happiness, you feel the good consequences of kindness, of generosity, of having a good heart, of being compassionate, of being peaceful, of having metta for the people around you. And also, see the opposite. See what happens when you do something bad. don't even have to do anything very bad because you have a bad thought, right? Almost everybody has a bad thought every now and again. It's very hard never to have any bad thoughts, right? So everybody, sometimes you just get upset with somebody. So even if you don't do anything, at least in your mind, oh, I wish this person, or whatever. You can feel it in the back, what I'm talking about. So, how does that feel sometimes when you have a negative thought about somebody else? Feel that feeling inside of you. And what you will feel is that if it is a bad thought, it very often depresses the mind into a dark state. Very often it takes away the energy, it takes away the joy, it takes away the mindfulness, it takes away all those beautiful qualities that you would have had if it wasn't for the fact that you thought a bad thought. Right? So look at that. And when you see that, hello, animals. Welcome. And when you see that in your heart and you see how it affects you immediately here and now, it makes you a bit concerned, right? Wow! It is not about when I get upset about something. Maybe, you know, it is about the other person. Actually, it is much more about me, how it affects me. That is the real worry here. And you can start to understand that if you keep on thinking negative thoughts, if you keep on thinking, doing bad acts, if you keep on saying the wrong words or whatever, you can see this will accumulate, it will build up, and it will drag your consciousness, drag the vinyana further and further down. On the other hand, if you do the good acts, because that is what you accumulate and build up, you will lift up your consciousness in exactly the same way. So when you feel this, and I would encourage you to try to see this, you just have to see the sense of urgency inside of you. Now is the time to do what is right. Now is the time to do what is good. Because of the power of these things, you understand the power, you get the sense of urgency as a consequence. This is one way to motivate you to do what is right in the world, because you understand the power of goodness and the danger of not doing what is right. You understand it from your own direct and immediate experience. This is the most powerful way of understanding these things. So try to see that, and you will understand what I mean by consciousness being raised or consciousness being held down or pushed down. Now, what is interesting about this is that when you raise your consciousness or you push down your consciousness, it means that over a lifetime you are moving often in one direction or another one. And then when you die, when you eventually pass away, your consciousness will have a certain level, right? Very often the level is pretty much where we started out. We got born, right? And then we're just messing around the whole life, enjoying this, enjoying that. And then we die, we're just where we started out, right? That's what we call in English a waste of a life, right? We had the opportunity, we didn't take the opportunity, we didn't do anything good with it. So we just waste our time. Then when we die, we think, what was that all about, you know? Kind of messing around, doing all these kind of things, but not really going anywhere. But, so the idea here is that when you practice a spiritual path, the idea is to gradually lift up your consciousness. That when you die, when eventually you come to that stage in your life, your consciousness is at a higher level than when you started out. And then when you're on your deathbed, you think, wow, well done me, right? I've done the right thing, I've lived a good life, I've actually done something, so I'm at a higher level when I die than when I started out. And then you know you can do the right thing. So you can imagine, if you die with a level of consciousness, which is at this level, what happens when you die? Well, because that is your level of consciousness when you die, that's where it's going to continue into the next life, right? That's what happens, right? If you have a low level of consciousness, because you have built that up during your life, that is where it's going to continue into the next life. So you can have some idea about your rebirth, about the future life, from how you are feeling in this life. That will give you some idea. Not 100%, because there are things that are their variabilities, like sometimes, you know, there are mindsets that are caused also by brain chemistry, all this kind of thing. Sometimes people have all kinds of mental illnesses, like schizophrenia or severe depression. Sometimes these things can be caused by imbalances in the brain, and then it doesn't really show us what is going on. But very often, the mind state that you have will be roughly equivalent. Have some idea of where it is that you're going to be reborn in the future. Give us some idea. And this is how rebirth happens, right? This is the level. This is why you can reborn at a certain level. This is how it goes. So this is how actually you can see why sankharas give rise to vijnana. Vijnana both in this life, but also vijnana, consciousness, upon rebirth itself. These things are very closely related to each other. And then when you get reborn at a particular level, the next step of dependent origination is vijnana pachaya nama rupa. Vijnana is the cause for nama rupa. Nama rupa basically is just experience. Nama rupa is a word for all our mental and physical feelings, right? All that is mental and physical in us. Feelings, the body, perceptions, all of these things. So once consciousness is at a certain level, you will have experiences that accord with that level. If you are reborn in a high level, your experiences will be good, right? They will accord with that level. If reborn at a lower level, they won't be so good. So this is what nama rupa means, that your experiences in that life would be a consequence of the level of consciousness that you have. So this is how it works. And on top of that, there's one more factor which is really needed to explain this really well. Because I was saying at the beginning, we think that we know where happiness is in the world, and for that reason we crave for that happiness. We go out, right, and do all of these things. Craving is always very close to us when we are searching for happiness in the world. We want to get rid of the suffering, and we want to find the happiness. That is always a search. It's always looking to the future, right? Always to the future somewhere. I want to be this kind of person. I want to continue living in the next life. It's called Bandha Tanha, the craving for existence. I want to have this sort of life. All of that is always about the future. So when you die, that craving is still there. And because the craving is about the future, that craving projects you into the future life. There's two things going on. One is the level of the consciousness, right, wherever that is. And the second thing is the craving, which is what projects you into the future, because craving is always about the future. If you have no craving, then you come to the next life. There is nothing to project you into the future anymore. And the process just stops as a consequence. So this is the idea, what I was talking about before. From avijja, from ignorance, arises this pursuit of happiness in the world, the elimination of suffering. From that pursuit, we then give consciousness, gets a certain level. At that level of consciousness, together with craving, lets you re-arise in the future in a new existence. Rebirth takes place. And in this way, the cycle goes on and on and on and on. For perhaps a very long time, right? If you don't get out of it, it's going to keep on going on. And that is why it is called suffering. After a while, oh, enough of all of this, right? Don't want to be part of this anymore. I want to get out of this. And then once you start to understand the problem of this, then you are on the path out of this. So this is roughly how to understand dependent arising. If you use this wisely in your own life, try to look at your heart, look at your mind, look at how your actions actually affect you right here, right now. You will get a very, very powerful motivation for doing the right thing. You will literally be seeing inside of yourself how the three first factors of dependent arising work. You will see that you act, right? You know it's from ignorance because you can assume that there is some ignorance there. You act and you can see how it affects you right there, right there. You're seeing dependent arising in practice as you do this. Okay, good. So, I have been talking for quite a while. And so I hope you understand at least a little bit of what I'm saying. Yeah, hopefully I have it relatively clear. Sometimes people say, oh, you talk too fast, please talk more slowly. I cannot understand. You have a strange accent. Where did your accent come from? But I can't do much about that, unfortunately. Yeah. So anyway, so I hope you have understood a few things of what I'm saying. And do you have any questions or comments or complaints or anything else that you would like to bring up at this particular stage? So please, this is your opportunity to ask a question if you like it. In the meantime, I'm going to put on my role probably.
Your
talk about
what can you do to ensure that you get better?
First thing to do is not believe everything you hear. That's the first thing. Because I don't really see that in the sutras. When you read the sutras, which really are the word of the world, I don't see that idea that the fourth mouth, fourth mouth is very important. This is really a major development that we find in the commentaries and is largely based on the Abhidhamma. So personally, the last four moments, obviously, it will have some impact. But the main impact that the Buddha always talks about is your general conduct in your life. The last four moments is not that important. The reason why that the last four moments has been given such emphasis in the Theravada Buddhism, I think if you go to other parts of Buddhism, often you don't find that. But one of the main reasons is because you have this idea that when you die, you go straight on to your next life afterwards. You have what is called a chuddhacitta, which is a passing away moment. And then you have a tathagata vinyana, which reconnects to your new life straight away. Now this is kind of the idea. I think I have an idea. It's not really found in the sutras. The interesting thing is that when you read the sutras, they actually seem to say that you're in and intermediate state. They seem to contradict this Abhidhamma idea, right? And when you go to some other schools of Buddhism, there's another school called the Sautrantika school, I think also the Mahasangika school, they also had ideas of being intermediate state. It wasn't just one Buddha from one line to the next one then. So, of course, if you're moving straight from the moment you die, straight to a new rebirth, then you can see why the idea of the last four moments is quite powerful, right? Because you're literally taking that last four moments directly with you into a new life. But if there is intermediate state, it's called the Antarabhava in Pali, if there is, of course, that changes the picture quite enormously then. Because it means that the last four moments, when you go into the intermediate state, everything has time to kind of settle down, and your natural, ordinary heart, if you have a good heart or whatever, that has time to come back again. And that last form has time to die away. It changes the equation quite enormously once you have the idea of a Antarabhava or intermediate state. So I personally, I don't have much doubt that it is an intermediate state from the early Buddhist sutras. There are very powerful indications of that. And I think this is perhaps one of the places where the traditional Theravada position, to me, doesn't look quite right. Maybe it can be sorted out if you just there may be reasons why it is like that. But to me, it often tends to all the space when it comes out there. And with the Antarabhava, there's time for your mind to sort itself out, for karma to ripen, and then to actually move on according to your karma, your general karma, right, that you have accumulated in life, rather than the last four moments. And all of this also fits very well with kind of modern ideas. You know, you hear about people having out-of-body experience, having near-death experiences. And all of these, to me, if you read them carefully, they seem to show that there is an intermediate state. You don't get reborn, bang, straight away. There's like an immediate existence where you have maybe a life with you, right? When you kind of go out of your body and you kind of see your relatives on the other side, and then there's like a feeling, oh, if I go up on a certain point, I can't go back again. I'm sure you have read about some of these, right? And these, to me, are very likely to be real experiences. And real experiences have to fit somehow with our sutras, right?
it's not good if the sutta say one thing and reality says something else. That's a bit of a concern. There has to be a correspondence between how we experience the world and how the Buddha teaches us. Otherwise, there is a problem there. So, yeah. So anyway, are you happy with that then? Yeah. Yes. I think it doesn't really say much in the sutras about the Buddha's way, is it? What it says, there is one very famous passage, or not famous to me because I'm not about it, but it says that some person asked the Buddha, after you die, but before you get reborn, what is it that sustains consciousness at that time? Right, you can't be much more clear, right? After you have died, but before you get reborn, what is it that sustains your mind or consciousness at that time? To me, that is a very clear indication of something in between there. And the Buddha answers, well, in that time between, it's craving that actually sustains it. In the same way that if you have a flame, and if you have a fire, and the wind comes along, and the wind blows a flame up in the air, what is it that sustains that flame? It's the wind that the Buddha has. Same kind of idea. But it doesn't say very much about what kind of existence it is. I think that maybe the best way to get some idea of that is to read some of the stories. And you can read about people having near-death experiences, right? And what that is like. Yeah. And very often it is a very delightful experience. It's delightful because you're getting out of your body, and perhaps your body has been very sick, right? It's falling apart, maybe you're old or whatever. Wow, out of my body, this terrible body of mine, which always giving me so much suffering. Yeah. And somebody comes and tells you, oh, it's not your time yet, you have to go back to your body. Don't want to go back to my body. I remember a few years ago, I went to Adam Brown, we went to a hospital, and there was a young woman who was dying of cancer. He was only in her 20s, right? Sometimes even young people die of cancer. And Adam Brown was there and said, wow, you are so lucky, you know, you're going to die now, get out of this cancer-ridden body, and get out of all of this thing. And now we're going to move on into the future. So there's this idea of, if you understand, I think, the idea of getting rid of your body is a beautiful thing, you know? You come to a vast state of life, it's actually very nice. And you get rid of the body, and as a consequence, you have a more, like, as you say, a spiritual kind of existence as a consequence. But for most people, especially people who have lived a good life, dying is often a very nice process. So keep that in mind and encourage your relatives and encourage your friends on the deathbed by saying, wow, actually, this is probably going to be much nicer than you think, right? And then they are so happy about that. This is a wonderful way to die, when you can die with happiness in your heart. Yes, sir. When does that happen? Well, this is a very difficult question to answer. And of course, that is the kind of thing which, because this is all about abortion and all those kind of things, right? Is abortion good? Is it bad? It's a very complicated question. And I don't know if I can give any final answer to that. But it seems like it can be during a long, quite a long period of time. It doesn't. The traditional view is that it happens straight away, as soon as kind of, you know, the embryo is kind of established, you have a consciousness must be there. But it is very hard to be sure, to be absolutely certain of that. And it seems that there are many possible views that actually are possible for it. So sometimes what you have to do is you just have to say, I don't know. Sometimes you have to kind of maybe feel it out or something. What does it feel like? What feels right? What feels wrong? And it's very hard to actually know what any position in those cases. So it would be nice to have a precise answer to these things, but sometimes there aren't any precise answers, unfortunately. One of the places in the sutras where he talks about this, it seems to say that three things have to be there for conception to take place. You have the mother has to be in the right season, the fertility has to be there, mother and father coming together, and the last one to the Gandhava has to be there. Gandhava is like a spirit or the consciousness from previous life being there. But interesting, this idea seems to be a Brahmanical idea, which here has kind of intruded into a Buddhist sutra. There is another sutra, the same thing is mentioned, but there it is mentioned as an idea that came from the Brahmins, you know, the Indian culture at the time, rather than being independent Buddhist idea. So sometimes we just don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah.
And so you have to almost like feel it out for yourself, what feels right and what isn't good. Yes.
Come on, forces you, right? It just continues on then, from there.
So
one way you can just think about that for Obama, one way of doing it, you can think about that as another rebirth, right? It's like an intermediate rebirth. So you have like a big rebirth there, and then you can come out in life, and then you can go on to the next one. Yeah. It's not solely mental energy. There's no such thing as solely mental energy. Because what you often have is when you come out of your body, very often there will be also be a physical aspect there, right? So it's like, you know, you said that in the sutra, it said that when you draw the mental body out of the physical body, you have a different physical body, which is how we find it. Well, the physical body that you leave behind will die, but that physical body that you bring with you, then that will then move with you, and it will be collected to be this kind. So sometimes in Western philosophy, they talk about what they call dualism. It's called, you know, the spirit on the one side and on the other side, and that's the reality. This is what the French philosopher Descartes, what he was talking about, you know, in the 17th century or whatever. But this is a very Christian, very European idea. It's not a Buddhist idea. Sometimes we have to be very careful to separate out what are ideas from different cultures. We mix them all up, but it's very kind of complicated after one day. The Buddhist idea is much more subtle than that. There is no absolute dualism between different substances. There is actually much overlap. This is one of the things you find out in the rebirth process. You actually take with you a more subtle aspect of form. So form has many degrees of subtlety, right? There's no absolute either spirit or materiality. There's different degrees of all of these kind of things. So you take with you one degree, and then that gets reborn into a higher degree. So kind of degrees and degrees that kind of get moved around. Okay, I think we have reached the end already. Very fast, right? We're having a good time. Time's already been very fast. Okay, so what do we do now then? Yes?
Can I just ask very quickly, dependent origination goes from life to life. I heard it, but dependent cessation happens momentarily. Very quickly.
It doesn't happen that quickly because actually happens over one life, right? Because when you when a vidya sees the sankhara stop it, and the sankharas, they are you just stop looking for happiness in those areas, right? So you don't do all this activity anymore, and then vijnana just stop straight away, because then the arahant wouldn't be conscious, right? It would be like a zombie arahant. So vijnana only stops, consciousness only stops when the arahant dies. So it's not entirely immediate, it goes over one line, basically.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Nice to see you all. Now we go back upstairs again, right? Now we're going to... Sorry? Yeah, okay, so how do we do that? Just, what is the time that we do? Okay, we'll just do this. How does it go again?
Idam me nam ho tu Sukhita bhavantu jnatayo Idam me jnatinam bhavantu Sukhita bhavantu jnatayo.